Good morning and welcome to Her Turn, a program of feminist news and information. I'm Christina Kivlin.
And I'm Eliza Howard. On today's program, we'll have a roundup of reproductive rights from across the country.
While the Biden administration has changed some of its language about Gaza, pushes towards a ceasefire at the UN Security Council bear no teeth.
The Gambia government threatens to become the first country to repeal a ban on horrific practices of female genital mutilation.
Activists in Malawi use social media to fight human trafficking to Oman.
Pauli Murray, a hero to civil rights and women's rights activists, embraced by lesbians and transgender folks alike. Yet many people still don't know Pauli Murray's name. Stay tuned to find out who this amazing person was from the perspective of Pauli Murray's niece.
So stay tuned for this and much more on the Sunday, March 24th edition of Her Turn.
A Nevada judge blocked a limit on Medicaid coverage for abortion services. The current program only covers abortion for pregnancies that are life-threatening or the result of rape or incest. Clark County Judge Erica Ballo plans to issue a written order to grant Medicaid coverage for all abortions. The American Civil Liberties Union argues that the current restrictions on Medicaid abortion coverage violate the Equal Rights Act because the restriction overly impacts poor people and people of color. Judge Ballo believes it is likely that her ruling will be appealed. The Nevada Attorney General's office declined to comment on whether the state plans to request a stay order amid the appeal. 17 states currently allow Medicaid to pay for abortions. The Pennsylvania High Court also revived a case to review their restrictions on Medicaid coverage for abortion in January. The American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, "Every person, regardless of income level or insurance source, deserves the power to make personal medical decisions during pregnancy," end quote.
Physicians are seeing an increase in birth control misinformation online targeting people in their teens and early 20s, particularly women of color. These communities have historically been impacted by a lack of transparency in the medical field. Forced sterilizations of tens of thousands of primarily women of color happened under U.S. governmental programs in the 20th century. Social media influencers are recommending, quote, "natural alternatives," unquote, such as timing sex to menstrual cycles. Doctors warn that this method could result in unwanted pregnancies in a country where abortion is now banned or restricted in nearly half of the states. Influencers argue that birth control can cause issues with weight gain, long-term fertility impact, and even alteration of whom they are attracted to. Medical experts say there is no evidence that birth control impacts fertility long-term. UW Stout student Catherine Miller said she had never wanted to use hormonal birth control due to the negative side effects she heard from anecdotes on TikTok. She took a class in human sexual biology taught by a family physician who walked the class through scientific research to dispel misconceptions. Miller said that her understanding of risk had been skewed by social media, and she worries about her generation of women facing a lack of information and choices. Physicians say little data is available about the scale of the misinformation, but doctors are noticing more patients are coming in with misconceptions about birth control fueled by influencers and conservative commentators. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists recommends physicians candidly discuss common side effects with their patients, and OBGYN Michael Belmont says that doctors stand a better chance of dispelling misinformation when they listen to patients' concerns.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case this week that will not only have major consequences, but is based on flawed research. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, or AHM, is suing the FDA over the safety of mifepristone, a pill used to induce miscarriages. The problem is the AHM is using flawed research to support its arguments, and the court may very well rely on that research. So-called researchers in the anti-abortion movement are publishing articles in respected magazines that refute studies that have long been accepted as proven science. Even though some of the articles are retracted, many courts don't care. If the FDA loses this case, it could mean abortion pills become illegal. It could also undermine the agency's authority to regulate many other medicines.
8 out of 10 Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders favor legalizing abortion, with 3 of 4 wanting it to become federal law. This according to a new poll from the AAPI data and the Associated Press. NORC Center for Public Affairs. Just over 6 of 10 Americans think abortion should be legal, says a poll done last year. The majority of Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders are Democrat, but over half of Republicans in this group want abortion to be legal, at least in some cases. That compares to less than 4 out of 10 Republicans in general. This is a fast-growing demographic, and their view on abortion could help it become legal on the federal level. On Friday, the United States introduced a draft resolution to the UN Security Council encouraging a ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution was ultimately vetoed by Russia and China and also voted against by Algeria. While stronger than previous American proposals, the resolution still failed to go as far as demanding a ceasefire, and the veto allows the Biden administration to shift blame for the Council's continued inaction to Russia and China. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! On Friday discussed the changes in the Biden administration language with Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace.
Using the word ceasefire, saying immediate ceasefire in some cases, we're seeing the New York Times is saying that the U.S. is introducing a resolution at the Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire. That's not the case. What it does is recognize the importance of a ceasefire and then says, and therefore we should support the negotiations that are underway in Doha, in Qatar. These are the negotiations that have been underway for weeks. They are mainly focused on the release of hostages as well as the parameters of a short-term ceasefire, probably 6 weeks. But the key thing is that the U.S. draft does not call for an actual Security Council call for a ceasefire. The language of 8 of the 10 elected members of the Security Council is much simpler and much more direct. It says explicitly that the Security Council demands an immediate ceasefire respected by all parties, leading to a sustainable ceasefire. Period, full stop. The U.S. language is very convoluted. It takes all of the authority out of the Security Council, makes the Council into essentially a group of cheerleaders for the existing negotiations that are underway. Security Council resolutions is part of international law. It's enforceable. It doesn't mean that it would be enforced, but it's a very powerful signal, something that an acknowledgement of the importance of a ceasefire is simply not that. The resolution by the 8 of the 10 elected members is a new development. This emerged only in the last several days. It is clearly in response to the massive escalation of political pressure, both from governments and from civil society, certainly here in the United States, but also around the world, where there is demand, there is outrage at the United States' position at the United Nations, which has been a consistent pattern that's gone on for months now, of vetoing in the Security Council any calls for a ceasefire and voting against it in the General Assembly where it has no veto, and using pressure, economic pressure, political pressure on other countries to encourage or in some cases really pressure them to vote against these resolutions. There is outrage growing, and the U.S. government and the Biden administration in particular is very, very isolated as a result. Here in the United States, we're seeing a huge escalation in the opposition to the Biden administration insistence on continuing to support Israel, sending military aid, despite the change in language, the recognition of famine that we just heard again from Secretary of State Blinken, the recognition of the humanitarian crisis that is killing people in the level of hundreds every day. And when we're hearing from the humanitarian experts, 55% of the entire population of northern Gaza right now is at the highest possible level of absolute famine, which means, Amy, that even if food began to be delivered on a large scale today. Probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of the most vulnerable people, primarily babies and children and the elderly, would be at risk of dying because their bodies have been so destroyed by the lack of food and water for so long.
Bennis stressed that over the last 15 years or so, the long-standing U.S. support for Israel militarily, economically, politically, and diplomatically has become a much more partisan issue.
Over the last 15 years or so, there's been a significant shift in how support for the long-standing U.S. support for Israel, military support, its economic support, its political and diplomatic support, how all of that shakes out in Washington. It's become a much more partisan issue, something that groups like AIPAC and other parts of the pro-Israel lobby have always wanted to avoid. They always wanted it to be a bipartisan consensus to support Israel. And it no longer is. The polls have been showing for years now that there's a massive shift underway. It's particularly generational, but it's also between parties. On the Democratic Party side, support for Israel has diminished profoundly. And on the Republican side, it's been a complete embrace of all things Israel. What we're seeing now is a continuation of that, certainly, with the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives following what happened in 2015, when the Republican leadership in the House at that time invited Netanyahu, who was the prime minister then as well, to address a joint session of Congress in order to pressure President Obama and oppose the Iran nuclear deal that was then being discussed. And it was one of these things that was diplomatically outrageous. It had never happened before. There was no consultation with the White House. Usually when a head of state comes, they're invited by the president. Not this time. Netanyahu ignored the White House, came at the invitation of the Republican leadership of the House, and gave a what amounted to a campaign speech in the U.S. Capitol as if it was his own capital, calling on the members of Congress to vote against their own president in the interest of his country. And in response, over 60 members, mainly of the progressive and especially the Black Caucus of the Congress, protesting the racism of Netanyahu towards President Obama, boycotted the speech, something that had never happened before. We're seeing essentially a repeat of that now, where he is emerging as a partner of the Republican opposition that is demanding more support for Israel, more money for Israel, more arms for Israel, at a time when the Biden administration itself, despite its change of language, is continuing to send more weapons and more money, trying to get Congress to approve $14 billion more in military aid to Israel without any conditions, in violation of U.S. law. And what we're seeing is a real shift on the political parameters. You mentioned earlier the diplomats and former military leaders in the United States who are calling for a reevaluation of the U.S. aid to Israel, saying that it must be conditional. It must not continue at this level. And we're seeing that coming from all kinds of new places, from funders of the Biden campaign. The pressure is mounting in ways that I've certainly never seen in decades.
That was Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace, interviewed Friday on Democracy Now!, which can be heard 5 days a week on WORT and anytime at all on democracynow.org.
Members of the Gambian Parliament are postponing a decision on whether to overturn the ban on female genital mutilation for at least 3 months. Member of Parliament Almama Giba introduced the bill with the goal to, quote, uphold religious loyalty and safeguard cultural norms, end quote. Three quarters of women between 15 and 50 have undergone female genital mutilation in Gambia. Anti-FGM activist groups fear that the proposed bill will lead to future violations of women's rights, including overturning laws around early and forced marriages. Jaha Dakura, the founder of an anti-FGM group, Safe Hands for Girls, said, "It was the most heartbreaking thing to watch men invalidate our experiences and reduce our pain to Western influence." The decision to overturn will be revisited in 3 months after the members of parliament called for more consultation.
Of 400 women interviewed in Oman by the U.S. State Department Trafficking in Persons report, almost all were found to be victims of human trafficking. Nearly a third said they were sexually abused, and half reported physical abuse. There are estimated to be around 2 million female domestic workers in the Gulf Arab state. Malawian woman Georgina was recruited to work as a driver in Dubai, but when she arrived in Oman, she realized she had been deceived and was working as a maid. Within weeks, she was sexually assaulted under threat of life. Georgina went on Facebook for help, and social media influencer Piliani Mombe Nioni created a WhatsApp group as a safe and private place to help Georgina. Nioni realized this was a widespread issue as more than 50 women joined the WhatsApp group. The women in the group shared stories of their abuse. One said, quote, "I feel like I am in prison. We can never escape. My life is really in danger," end quote. Oman's National Committee to Combat Human Trafficking and the relationship between employer and domestic worker was contractual, and unsettled disputes can be referred to court within a week. Georgina was able to return home after 3 months in Oman with the help of Nioni. Georgina's case allowed Nioni to pressure the Malawi government to intervene. Malawian Charity Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives launched an Oman rescue campaign calling on authorities to bring the women home. A spokesperson from the Malawi government told the BBC it is developing rules, quote, "to ensure the safe, orderly, and regular migration that benefits migrants, their families, and the country at large," end quote. Nioni says the issue of trafficking in Oman highlights a bigger problem in Malawi. Nioni said, quote, "If young women had job opportunities in Malawi, they are not going to be trapped. We need to fix the nation so that these youngsters will never be trapped again," end quote.
Girls in Afghanistan have to stay home again as the new school year starts this month. This is the third year in a row that the Taliban has kept girls from attending high school and beyond. Islam says there is an obligation to educate both men and women, but the Taliban insists their religion forbids girls from attending school. They're the only country in the world with this policy. Women and girls are banned from all forms of public life in Afghanistan, and it doesn't look as if that will change anytime soon.
If you're still using cash money, watch your change, especially your quarters. Since 2022, the U.S. Mint has been putting women on millions of the 25-cent pieces. Names like Maya Angelou, Wilma Mankiller, and Eleanor Roosevelt have been appearing. And this year, the Reverend Dr. Polly Murray's face will appear. If you don't know who that is, you're not alone. Her Turn reporter Arlene Zoucha has more.
When I've mentioned this feature to folks, many have commented that they don't know who the Reverend Polly Murray is, even though Murray is regarded as one of the most important social justice advocates of the 20th century. So as the niece of Reverend Polly Murray, what would you like people to know?
Well, I'd like them to know that she was a transformational civil rights activist born in Baltimore, who grew up in Durham, North Carolina. I admit that very few people had heard about her for many reasons. The time that she was born, the fact that she was studying to become a lawyer and therefore worked often behind the scenes, writing up the legal briefs for what the group should do as opposed to being on stage. Also because men usually were the ones featured at that time. She was a civil rights activist. She worked for women's rights. She worked for gender rights. And most importantly, as far as she was concerned, for expanding human rights. She felt that all people were equal to each other, regardless of their background, their age, their culture, their religion. We were all equal to each other. And so she worked for everyone's rights and anyone who suffered from oppression.
I was pretty impressed when I read about what kind of an influence she had on, well, two different Supreme Court justices, on Thurgood Marshall, with Brown versus Board of Education, with that landmark decision, and also with Ruth Bader Ginsburg commented that she was the influence for the sex discrimination case that expanded the Equal Protection Clause.
I think that those two major things were some of the reasons why she has become more well known. When some Hollywood production company was doing RBG, the documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg kept speaking about attorney Pauli Murray. And they stopped and asked her, well, who is this person? We've, you know, never heard of her. And she mentioned that she considered Aunt Pauli a mentor, and also that she had been impressed and utilized many of her theories. Also, she was the first Black female priest in the Episcopal Church. When she was deemed a saint in 2012, that sort of elevated interest in her as well. Her work on Brown versus the Board of Education was monumental. And of course, that's something that affected all of the schools and all of the students in the entire United States, as well as other things where there were separate but equal facilities for non-white people.
She was so ahead of her time and so brilliant because she was hardly out of law school when Thurgood Marshall saw her arguments about that case.
Exactly. She actually started that when she was a junior in Howard University School of Law. She was the only female. Her professors were male and all of the other students were male. And when she would share some of her theories or research that she had done, they would often sniggle and laughed at her, but they definitely dismissed her. They thought that the things that she discussed were so far-fetched, they would never happen. And one of those things was actually the separate but equal clause in the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision. And that's basically what was used when Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP team went before the Supreme Court and won in Brown versus Board of Education.
I have heard some folks, because in her private writing she had a struggle around some of her gender identity issues, I've heard some folks use they and them pronouns. What's your take on that?
Well, first I must say our lives intersected for 43 years. And of course, I only knew her as my aunt. I had the kind of relationship I think any one of her favorite nieces would have with an aunt. We were very close. We seldom lived in the same city, but we certainly saw each other at all kinds of family activities. And I actually lived in her apartment in New York City for a year. So I only knew her as a female. I only knew her as an aunt. She and I had never had any discussions about that. However, as people have had the opportunity, including myself, to look at some of the personal papers, tapes, recordings, videos that she turned over to the Schlesinger Library, there were like 130 some boxes of materials. So people have had some opportunity to read her own words. I got an opportunity to read a letter that she wrote a doctor asking for explanations of why she felt the way she did, if something could possibly be that she was born in a female body but possibly had some male organs. Because at that time, this was a subject that was not well known or talked about in the 1920s. So I did read some of the personal letters that she had typed or written to psychologists, psychiatrists, asking for medical explanations. Also, because of her interest in supporting all people in any community, including the trans community, even though it wasn't called that at that time, people have decided they want to categorize her using they, them, or he or she. What I say to people is, because for 43 years I only knew her that way, it was definitely an aunt to niece relationship. that I will always think of her that way, but I honor them and understand why they like to or feel it's appropriate to call her with other pronouns or consider her a part of their special community. And I absolutely support that. I can add that it was actually the weekend before she died of pancreatic cancer that she shared with one of the two remaining siblings who was still alive, my Aunt Mildred and her daughter Bonnie, and Bonnie's daughter Lisa, that she had had a very important long-term relationship with a woman named Rennie, or whom she called Rennie. It was very important to her and very loving, and it only terminated because Rennie died of cancer.
Well, thank you so much for sharing those insights. And I do think we all can claim her as our hero, really. Do you have any kind of special memory you'd like to share with us, a personal experience with your aunt?
One of the things that was very important to her was a friendship that she developed with Eleanor Roosevelt. She began by writing President Roosevelt about lynching. She was horrified by the fact that people of color in the South, where she actually grew up as a child, were being lynched quite frequently, and nothing was happening. There was very little effort to find out who the people were who were lynching them. They seldom were brought to justice or jailed, even when they knew that they were from the Ku Klux Klan, or even knew who the people were, because they often boasted about what they had done. There was nothing done in terms of the law. So she wrote a very strong letter to the president, and Eleanor Roosevelt saw the letter. The president said that he needed the support of Southern politicians, and so he could not come down hard on them to stop it. Eleanor Roosevelt agreed often in Aunt Polly's words and her opinions, and she tried on many occasions to get the president to support them. But she would often tell Aunt Polly, but you have to be patient. These things will take time. They can't happen overnight. But in this about 20-year friendship, they did become true friends. And my favorite memory of Aunt Polly was Aunt Polly picking me up at Penn Station in New York City for my big trip to meet Eleanor Roosevelt. I was wide-eyed, ecstatic. I had my two Brownie cameras. Mrs. Roosevelt was very gracious. I walked in on a meeting with her, with the Prime Minister of Israel and a newly appointed Jewish female judge for the city of New York, and some high-level Protestant ministers. And just as though I were not there, after everyone said hello to me and I was given cookies and what have you, they let me sit there and listen to them go on talking about world affairs. And I knew better than to interrupt. But when Aunt Polly and I left, I was just telling her how excited I was that I got to see Golda Meir and these other important people, and to see Eleanor Roosevelt interact with her as a true friend and colleague and equal. She had also signed 14 autographs for me to give to the people that I designated and take pictures. And also, this is a memory I will always have, and I think probably let me know that Aunt Polly was truly someone of importance, if she was a friend of the First Lady. But I still didn't know the kinds of things she had worked on, the kinds of things she did, and the impact it made on the country.
It's a great story. How old were you at the time?
I was 14.
So now we're going to be able to see the Reverend Polly Murray on a quarter.
Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful turn of events. It was all a big secret that wasn't to be discussed until the Secretary of the Treasury announced it And it's been very exciting to not only be getting more attention on all that she did in the area of education, law, religion, voting rights, and those kinds of things, but to know that she was actually going to be on a quarter. And the artist used hope as a part of the imagery for her quarter, which was something that she maintained her entire life, no matter how many times she met oppression, either as a female or as a Black person. She never gave up hope. She always persevered. She was always positive. It was also the name of her autobiography, Hope is a Song in a Weary Throat.
That was Rosita Stevens Holsley, the niece of the Reverend Polly Murray and the president of Preserving Polly Murray, LLC. She is also the co-author of the young people's book, Polly Murray, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist and Civil Rights Activist. Books by Polly Murray herself include The Story of Her Genealogy, Proud Shoes, and her autobiography, Song in a Weary Throat. If you'd like more information, you can check out the website, preservingpollymurray.com. Rosita Stevens Holsley wants to hear from you. For her turn, I'm Arlene Zoucha.
Sources used in assembling today's edition of Her Turn include Democracy Now!, The Washington Post, The BBC, AP News, ABC News, The Guardian, and the Feminist.org Newswire.
Today's edition of Her Turn was produced by Joanne Powers, who is also our on-air engineer. Other contributors include Arlene Zoucha, Sani Jandigold, Eliza Howard, and Christina Kivlin. Now stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with host Julia. For Her Turn, I'm Eliza.
And I'm Christina. Have a fierce day. And I wish that I could say.
Hi, my name is Vicki Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not